Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It's a U.S. bailout, part two. Unemployment rate is at 8.6%. We have a global coordinated action to bail out Europe. And our special guest today, Peter Schiff. All this and a lot more on episode number 241 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, how are you? It's been wild 2 weeks of just incredible downstrokes on the market. And then out of nowhere, right? Kind of like just what happened? You wake up in the morning and boom, markets are up 3, 4% on pre-market. Pretty much you couldn't do anything about that on Wednesday if you thought about it, because already the markets had been, or pre-markets had been driving higher at about, I guess it was about 5 or 6, I remember seeing a futures chart. And, well, I wasn't up, but that's when I saw the chart back to. And it was because China had decided that they're going to reduce the requirements or kind of just loosen the requirements on their banking and reserve requirements. Now, the thing is that it's kind of interesting because China for a long time has been saying that they're going to fight inflation. They're going to make sure they don't have a hard landing. They're going to make sure that they pull back on this whole bubble that's forming when it comes to their real estate market. And yet, amazingly, you see a number on ISM come out in the contraction zone last week. Their official manufacturing number was sub 50, lowest in, I think it's about 24 months or so. And yet they have been on a tightening, just an absolute tightening parade, going and looking at not only interest rates, but they're looking at raising yuan because they want to encourage more domestic consumption rather than exporting, so they say. And at the same time, doing whatever they can to clamp down on inflation. You saw that their food prices did come down a bit, and they are slowing in terms of their CPI and their PPI. That's all good. But then you have to wonder, well, with all that, why are they now opening up the reserve requirements? In other words, requiring banks to have less money on hand compared to loans if they still have a dramatic problem with housing. And then on top of that, that same day, we saw 5 or so countries come in and what'd they do? They basically lowered the cost of borrowing in dollars to Europe. These countries came together and they worked with the overnight swaps and reduced the interest rate down for this very short-term swap arrangement of dollars to euros to about 0.5% over the OIS spread. So there is a there was about a 50 basis point reduction. That was good. And markets really got, boy, they got excited. I think it was more than it had to be. It had to be more than just the simple cutting. In other words, it wasn't just they cut the rates. It was the fact that there was a coordinated global effort with major economic powers around the world that came in to do something because the leaders, in quotes, of Europe weren't doing anything. They were just, you know, kind of kicking, not only kicking the can, they weren't even looking at the can down the road. So I think that what that represented to investors was two things. First of all, coming into this, there was a good amount of increase in short interest ratio. Liquidity was down because volume has been down of late, you know, overall. And now you have a lot of people short or out. And what happens? You have this kind of news and it drives markets up initially in the futures market by 2-3%. And all of a sudden, those people that are short, those hedge funds, those institutions that we're going short, and there's a lot of them, they have to cover very quickly. That starts the initial rise. Then everybody hops on board, and it just got pretty crazy. But again, if you look at that chart for the day, it really happened all overnight. You couldn't have gotten in on it if you wanted to. Maybe 0.25%, maybe, by the end of the day when that little spike up happened. And, you know, what happened from there is that things kind of came flat. Now, we saw a great, again, quote-unquote, great unemployment number come out on Friday. And that was encouraging to a lot of people because they saw the unemployment rate drop to 8.6%. They saw about 123,000 people put back on the payrolls. But there was a lot of skepticism after that number came out. Initially, as it came out, as a matter of fact, I'll go back to your futures discussion for a second. The S&P futures drove up at about 3 in the morning out of nowhere. Just if you take a look at a futures chart and look at the S&P futures on Friday morning, 3 a.m., they spiked. Why? I don't know. Was there a leak of the data? Maybe. Was there just, you know, pure optimism in Europe? Maybe. Whatever it was, it spiked. And it kept on going higher and higher. And when the employment number came out, everybody was very excited. And again, you got back to that short covering again because people thought it was going to be, you know, there's a lot of optimism, but yet at the same time, there was a lot of pessimism going into it. And the 8.6 came out, and boy, futures, you know, drove right up. Then by the end of the day, did you notice that the whole thing was taken back? At the end of the day on Friday, the 1.7% move that was initially brought in by the futures right up until the unemployment number came out just left. Why is that? Well, one of the things that happened was that you saw that the unemployment number was good, you could say that, and the dollar started to rise, or the euro started to drop. You know, the euro, in our opinion, is very much overvalued. It's being held up by artificial means. It's being held up by a repatriation trade. It's being held up by the Chinese and a variety of other countries that are trying to diversify. But at the same time, the valuation, the real core valuation of the euro is not where it should be. Should it be 120, 130? It's definitely lower. So when we see that the dollar starts to rise, there is this inverse trade often where you have a lot of the materials companies and or, let's say, metals and oil. And you start to see a bit of a leakage in those areas because they're very much tied to the dollar. Not only that, there's a lot of trades put on in a, we'll call it a spread trade or an arbitrage trade where you have a position in maybe short dollars and you go out and you buy something else, whether it's a currency or whether it's a material, a commodity, or whether it's a stock. So you have to start worrying about how much that dollar is going to go up and maybe start to close that position. And the other side, you know, gets hurt. And what happens is you get a rise in the dollar. Well, the dollar rose throughout the day on either the fact that it was a strong number or it was the fact that there is additional concern in Europe. And a lot of money said, you know what, I'm going to take money off the table and just put it safe for a little while after we had this humongous run up for 2 days, about 7%. And so that's where we have it. Now, you have to, again, wonder, can these markets move higher if the dollar moves higher? Yeah, it's happened in history, no question about that, and it's very possible. But you also have to look at the makeup of what's going on in this market, this the capitulation almost on a daily basis. Barton Biggs, we wrote a story about him, I think Thursday or Wednesday of last week. Barton Biggs, he's the hedge fund manager over at Traxys Partners, billions of dollars he manages. I find it so interesting when he comes out on a regular basis and says, you know, we are, let's say, I don't know, 60% stocks. We're bringing it up. We were at 30, we're bringing it to 60, and the next time he comes on, he's at 80, and the market, you know, has moved up recently, and that's when he usually comes on. And then on the other side, you know, you see that the market sells off terribly, and, you know, you hear a month later, Barton Biggs comes on and says, yeah, we dropped our exposure down to 20. We're probably going to reduce it down more. Matter of fact, about a month ago, he came on and said, hey, we dropped it down to 40, and we're probably going to take it down 15% lower. And then just this week, so we're talking about 2.5 weeks later, he said, you know what, even though he said he was bearish and there's nothing to look forward to, I was too bearish. There is a lot less bearishness that you really should have, and I'm paraphrasing, and numbers are coming in better, and he boosted it up to 60%. Now, I don't understand what the point of him coming on and doing that is, because he seems to be after the fact. Okay, that's all right. You don't want to jump on board right away. You want to make sure the trend is solid. I get that. But at the same time, this is exactly what's going on and why the market is making these just dramatic moves almost in an instant. Because these hedge fund managers, they have what they call basket trading. So let's say they have 25, 30, 10, 100 different stocks. They trade futures, they may trade metals, but let's just stick to the stocks for 1 second. So if they have a basket of, let's say, 25 different stocks, what they could do is immediately when they flick a switch, just immediately buy in or sell out of those rapidly. And that's where you see that gigantic drawdown in individual stocks when they're selling and volume pickup, and the opposite true when they're buying. And it's this, as it's been coined these days, this risk-off, risk-on trade where, and it's almost, again, it's almost like a panic. Panic in, panic out, panic in, panic out, which is making it very choppy and very difficult to read what the trend is. Almost impossible. Because if you really ask around and you find out, you know, from various measures where the trend is, you'll see that there is a real dispersion of what people believe. The downtrend seems secure right now, yet we see an intermediate uptrend right now, clearly. No question about that. We popped through two levels. I don't think that's ever happened. Two of our trend indicator levels in 2 days. I honestly don't think that ever happened. I'm not sure. I'm not sure either love it or hate it. Because do you say, okay, well, that's a really strong signal for a continuing bull run? That's a rally and a really strong rally ahead? Or is it simply just a short covering panic move, capitulation style from a bottom that is going to be very short lasting on any news that comes out that may disrupt markets? Yeah, interesting. So what we're looking at right now is this kind of this bifurcated market situation. There was somebody sent me Lowry's. It's a group that does research, and they have a specialty, I guess we can call it, that they look at this whole area of how much oversold, overbought. They have indicators that show them how much of a percent day, in other words, how much of the volume, how much of the makeup of the markets were up that day, and it gives them signals and all this. Well, there's something called the 90% up day, which we saw that happen on Wednesday. Now, this is what they wrote. I want to just read this to you. They said on September 18, 2008, the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan, among others, announced coordinated measures designed to improve liquidity in the global financial markets. The U.S. market responded with a 90% up day that lifted the Dow Jones Industrials by about 3.8% and the S&P by about 4.5%. Sound familiar? The rally followed through on the next day with another 4% rise in the S&P. But that was it. After the market rolled over into a decline to November 20th, 2008, which was the low in which the S&P lost 37%. This brief history lesson is not meant as a purpose to highlight that big one-day gain, but rather as a signal that one-day gains in the market do not necessarily lead to major rallies. In fact, from a historical standpoint, big rallies such as the ones on November 30th and September 18th, 2008, are much more common in bear markets. I thought that was interesting. So there's a little bit of a history there. And they go on to say that the analog that they look at, and it can't always be duplicated and replicated, and you don't know which one is going to work out, because there's other examples of similar situations that happened in history. They, as a matter of fact, cite a few of these. And they look at, for example, 1970, 82, and 90. But there were some different conditions out there at the time. And so what is this saying? I think that it's saying that it isn't time to be necessarily fooled. If the markets are going to continue in a direction, and they're going to continue up because of whether it's earnings, the problem solved, the December 9th meeting with the European Union is going to come to finally a conclusion, and even though they do, who knows what that really means. And we have to be a little bit on our toes right here. So one of the things I'm thinking of is, all right, you know, there's some great quality stocks out there, and, you know, you have your technicals that hit right, okay, buy them, great. You have your fundamentals that are good, okay, great. Now, what do you do maybe on the other side to look at the volatility? Well, the VIX has fallen dramatically. Have you seen it? It fell down from, down maybe 18 points. It's down a chunk in the last few weeks. Now, last couple of weeks, I should say, kind of just really, really pulled back. Well, the VIX, if you look at a chart of the VIX, which is the options that are, well, they call the fear indicator, but it's really a volatility indicator, okay? They're in the 25 range or so right now. And if you look at a chart, a daily chart of them, and you pull up a 50 and a 200-day moving average, you could also pull up 100. But I want you to look at that because the VIX has a really interesting way of either staying with lately, and especially in 2011, the 200-day moving average, or getting real close and bouncing off? If you look back almost every month throughout 2011, we've seen this crazy pattern. Besides the summer, this is the exception of the summer, of it's up 1 month, the markets, equities, S&P, Dow Jones, and then down the next month, and then up the next month, and then down the next month. And then, again, you have some sideways action and all. But I'm saying from a, if you look at just the dailies just kind of segregate and just stare at the months for a second. And one of the things that it's doing is clearly creating volatility, right? Because the moves, even if it has opened up and closed at the same price in the month, let's say, it's been a lot of movement in between. So the volatility has been pretty substantial. Now, what you could do is you could actually utilize the volatility, the VIX, which in a sense will work often opposite of what markets do. When markets move up, the VIX will move down. When markets move down, the VIX will move up. Okay, we've talked about the VIX before. And what you could do is you can actually go out and buy the VIX, whether you buy it through an ETF. TVIX is one that we use. You could use a double, a single, an inverse, the direct. You could use the VIX option itself. They act, you know, work like options. And that obviously has more bang for the buck, but then you have a time constraint on it. And just for a short term, when you see this 200-day on Friday get touched, and then it jumped right off. I thought it was interesting. It almost to the exact level, just like a market will do, just like a stock will do, but inverse. Got to its 200-day, fell down, and boom, bounced right off. Now, does that mean it's going to continue in the other direction? No, it does not, but we could say that the drop that we've seen lately was pretty significant, and buying the volatility right now is a lot cheaper and a good option if you want to have either some protection or play the potential downside. Either way, you could look at it that way. Now you can trade it. You can move in and out of it if you use the ETF or even the option. And if you look at what's going on and there's a sense that the rally that we've just seen is going to be temporary, this will do very well. On the other hand, if all of a sudden we have this just, mad dash to the end, this Santa Claus, Hanukkah, Harry rally till the end of the year, we're going to see a drop of that. But you can always sell that. That's okay. And you'll have your long positions that you have because of the good quality fundamentals and the technicals that are making sense that you look at and you find the right pattern and uptrend. It's moving, obviously, from bottom left to top right, 45-degree angle, not too choppy, although you're not going to find that lately. And you're going to see it maybe breaking out over a resistance area or bouncing on a very important support zone. Now, with that in mind, seems like a no-brainer to me. And you'll have some intraday volatility that it moves around, of course, back and up, down and, back. We just picked some up on Friday in the morning, and it was down, 4%, 3% or something like that in the beginning of the day, and the VIX ended up flat or so by the end of the day. So that was nice to get that nice discount, if you will, on that big pop in the morning when the markets were just flying high. So, just take a look at that as an idea, something that I want you to ponder, think about, and, just kind of put it in the back of your idea. This is not something to hold on to forever, by the way. Do not think you just buy this and put this. This is not that. Nope. You need to buy this if you're going to buy it, and possibly even sell it when the opposite happens, right? You can use it on both sides. You can go long, you can go short. So when the market is in a gigantic run, you can always sell the VIX, sell the volatility, and you can buy the volatility, okay? So let's talk a little bit about the economics of what's going on here. So the jobless claims that we saw last week, the initial jobless claims were over 402, the big 400 number, important, and it actually crossed over the four-week moving average. That was a kind of a negative sign, but that was on Thursday. And then Friday, we saw 123,000 jobs gains, 8.6. But here's the little caveat I want to make on the 8.6. Lest we think everything is just really ducky right now and just happy-go-lucky and employment really is doing amazing. First of all, a lot of the employment was probably temporary due to the retail. But at the same time, you have to. It's not somebody debunking this just to be debunking it. You have to look at the labor participation rate when we see the jobs number, the unemployment rate come out. Because If you think about it for a second, you have to look at any statistic at the way it is calculated, formulated, and compiled. The reason for this is it's pretty simple. What happens is that the more people that leave the workforce, the less of a overall impact this number has, because if you have a 9% unemployment rate, okay, and now all of a sudden a chunk of those people that were unemployed just leave the workforce, that 9% will fall. What happens is as they leave the workforce, they're no longer considered unemployed. And a few hundred thousand people, I think 335, I think it was, or 400, left the workforce last month out of disgust, despair, retirement, no jobs, no process to get one, or whatever else it may be. They left the workforce. And therefore, that adjustment, if you really do the calculation, we're still at 9%, right about 9%. Because if you calculate what that would have been if those people did not leave the workforce, and by the way, that's not what you want to see. You want to see the opposite. You want to see more and more people getting excited about the potential for a job and going out and getting a job, at least looking, and then claiming that they're unemployed. Because the more people that are out there, the more opportunity they believe it is, and that's really a consensus on what they see in the economy. Okay? So again, just be careful with that number and those headline numbers that we're seeing, because you have to dig down on some of this. You have to look a little bit beneath the basic line, because some of these indicators were built a long time ago and aren't as important. And also, don't forget, some of the silver lining folks over at stations that won't be identified, you know, they're just going to find the better part of any kind of report, and that's good. They like to be happy and they want to find it. But you know what? Let's have some realism here. It goes both ways. A lot of times, some people are just finding the bad stuff. I mean, we have a couple of economists that just send us things that are just always negative. What is going on here? That doesn't look so negative. It looks pretty good, as a matter of fact. So anyway, it works both ways. Now, I wanted to mention a couple other things. Let's start with the politics, I guess. You know, obviously, we saw this weekend a very big change in the Republican. It's getting to be almost a comedy, but unfortunately, Kaine has now at least stepped back from his Republican bid to be the president of the United States. And obviously, there's just too many affairs and other miscellaneous happenings that are going on. It's either true or not true. Who knows? Whatever it is, but it's obviously detracting from his ability to either focus, and probably would have detracted from his potential for getting the vote. So now it looks like we have a big switcheroo that happened here, that it's a Romney-Gingrich potential shootout. Interesting. I just find the whole thing to be almost laughable, because, you know, the field that is right now, it just, I don't know. You know, I don't know about you, but it just seems like we have to really get this a little bit more focused, because it's been a little bit of, I think at this point, you know, there's no front runner here. There hasn't been a real powerful player there. And that's okay. I mean, you know, we want to make sure that both sides have the opportunity. We'll find out who has the best story. But right now, that's a big change. I don't think that's going to affect anything right now. You know, it's too early still, I think, in this whole weeding out process to, you know, figure out. But once we do find someone who is going to be the player, we'll see how the markets do, in fact, react. So I just thought that was an interesting point. Lululemon. They are, you know who they are. They're the clothing company, the athletic gear company for women, especially in yoga. And that's where they started and specialized. And the store's just been doing incredibly well, amazingly well. High priced, but just still very much in demand. And what was interesting is they came out with earnings on Thursday, and the stock just got crushed, down about 16% on the earnings. You know, they hit their earnings, but here's what happened. Their management guided down, had a real dour forecast. As a matter of fact, they were really kind of, it was really just downright ugly, their overall, it just, you know, for them, I should say. And the stock sold off dramatically in humongous volume. And then started rising. And it got to a point where it hit a major resistance point and then started coming back down. Now, that rise came from 16% down, and it ended right there at that bounce point, if you will, or resistance point. It was about 5% down, 6% down or so. And then something amazing. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it was an upgrade of the company, and the stock started to kind of rise again. Anyway, the stock finished about 3% down for the day, and the next day it was up 5%. I think for the whole ordeal for the week, it was probably flat or a little bit up. But the point was, wow, we're talking about a massive amount of drop, and that is not just from retail. Institutions had to be dumping as well. So you have to wonder what is going on with this kind of movement. Has it crossed your mind? Like, what is going on? Like, one day this guy loves it, drives it all the way up. The next day some analyst hates it and just, you know, gets crushed. I mean, it is this, well, it's a couple of things. First of all, it is the, it's a lot of this movement that is out to just make money on the movement rather than the fundamentals that are really riding things right now. And that's okay. That happens. The technicals are very valid. And you have to respect that. But at the same time, it's almost, it's so orchestrated in a way, you know, you kind of drive it down, you press it down, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, you turn it and you squeeze the crap out of the shorts. So anybody that doesn't like shorts, I talked about this last week. If you don't like shorts, if you don't like the short selling, if somebody says, hey, you know what, those short sellers, they're just creepy people that are just screwing up the markets. It's un-American, blah, 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 blah. You know what? Think about it for a second. One of the reasons the market had such an amazing bouncing from their point in this week was because of the immediate short covering that went on when good news came out. Bam! The short covering is usually the spark to create any rally. The short covering is what really is the essence of the markets being able to find a place that the selling stops. And even if buying doesn't start from traditional long-only buyers, the seller is saying, hey, you know what? It's time to take profit. And it turns it around. And that's how the mechanics, very basically, how the mechanics of that works. If you don't have anybody that's willing to buy, it just keeps getting either sold or never will pick up. But you almost get a double benefit. If you think about it, you have not only the wind at your back as a long in certain circumstances when the short covering goes on, but the short covering feeds upon itself because the buyers are coming in and then they're getting even more spooked and getting out. So that's really kind of a big issue. I think that you need to think about that. I have a few people I know that really just, you know, think, oh, the short selling, oh, it should be outlawed. No way. It's the reason why we can have these great bounces. Anyway. Next week, we're going to see the ISM number. We saw the manufacturing number in the United States. That was pretty good. Still down from where it was. And we saw China come in, obviously, sub and contracting. But I think it's really interesting how the United States, our economy, seems to be incredibly resilient, doesn't it? Great. You see that pretty much around the world. You look at Asia, a lot of Asia. You look at, no question, you look at Europe. And what you see is a significant, you know, drop-off. Let me give you a couple of stats here. Measure of European manufacturing fell about 46 from 47, the lowest in 28 months. Russian manufacturing rose a bit from 50 to 52. France unemployment increased to 9.7 from 9.6. And Dutch manufacturing fell to 46 from 48. Swiss contracted from 44 to 40 from 46. China manufacturing fell from 49 to from 50. I mean, you know, it keeps on going and going. Australian home building approvals fell 10%. And South Korea did well. They increased about 13% year over year. But what we're seeing is this big slowdown that's happening. And somehow, interestingly, for whatever reason, and it doesn't matter the reason, whether you want to say it's stimulus or when you want to say it's just that we're indestructible, if you want to say that it's bad statistics, you want to say that we're, you know, the dollar's low, whatever it is. The fact is that the U.S. manufacturing has held up. And by now, you would think, if you look at the trend that we saw recently, that it should have broken down a little bit more than it did. I think that next month probably will be the telltale because you could say that this month a lot of inventory was going on and restocking, but I don't think so. From everything that we saw and the evidence that was seen by a lot of the conversation by retail and manufacturing, it wasn't a big inventory restock cycle because there was worry that, you know, the customer wasn't going to be there. So I think that, you know, next month I think we'll have, you know, the next month from this month, this December's and January's, but December's number will be very telling of really what's going on in terms of the manufacturing index. Next week, we're going to see, this week, we're going to see the ISM services index. And again, that was supposedly moved higher. And I'll bet, you know, pretty much it did. You know, you had a few things happen that were interesting. First of all, you had a lot of restaurants decided to be open during Thanksgiving. And there was an unbelievable spike in the meals that were served that day. A lot of people say, you know what? We're not cooking. We're not doing it. It's expensive. We got to clean up. We got to have the family. We're going to take everybody out maybe, or just our family out. We're going to go out to XYZ restaurant. And that was a great thing. You know, Chinese restaurants are only closed on Thanksgiving. I got to figure this out if they still did this. But Chinese restaurants, most Chinese restaurants, if you go up and you ask them, when are you closed? They'll tell you, you know, maybe one other date, but they're closed Thanksgiving. Well, some of these other restaurants probably figured out that, you know what, maybe there's a niche here that pretty much every restaurant is closed. What if we open up a few? Let's see how it does. Maybe just as a test this year. And they were pretty satisfied with the results. So that's going to be part of the service index. And I'll, like I said, I think that could be a very interesting read on things. And, you know, restaurants and companies and retail and individuals and entrepreneurs, they're getting very creative. And that's good. That's what we need. That spirit of changing the norm, changing, you know, what has been done that hasn't been working as well. So I think that is really the core of what's going on. I'm going to see what else we got here before we get to, I got Peter Schiff coming on in a second. RIM, Research in Motion, taking a gigantic piece of profit out because they're dropping the price already on their not selling playbooks. And I think they dropped, I think, another 10% on Friday. And the stock just looks, it's getting to a point of being sad. You look at the stock, you're like, oh, man, that's bad. That what a sad story. Maybe they deserve it. Maybe they don't. Maybe they didn't keep up with it. Maybe they made some very poor management decisions. Yes, that is true. Maybe they were behind the curve on their technology. Yes, that's true. Maybe they overhyped and underdelivered. Absolutely true. And maybe the stock really deserves to be here. Well, you know what? Things are where they are. Things are priced where they're priced because they should be. One other thing I mentioned, we're going to write up about a stock called Acorn. They're a company. They're a medical healthcare company. They do pharmaceuticals, but for eyes, you know, ophthalmology. And they have just a slew of products. Came out with earnings last week, and great numbers. We usually don't have these stocks that make our lists. Stocks that are under $10 and, you know, that are in this class. But somehow, the earnings consistency of this company really stands out. So I want you to take a look at it. Acorn is the name, A-K-O-R-N, is the name of the company. We'll put up something on the Disciplined Investor this week about it, one of our reviews and our information about it. And if you want to get it first, you got to follow me on Twitter, simply at Andrew Horowitz. That's over at Twitter. You can check that out. And follow me over there. Let me mention before we get to Peter Schiff that, hey, GoToMeeting. This time of year, kind of holiday time. You know, we get bad weather where you are. You get sick days. Everybody's in the same room. That cough or the sneeze. And I don't know about you. I can't do that. Somebody gets sick around me, I start taking those natural cold remedies. And all. The thought of getting the flu and all that just is overwhelming to me. I don't like to be sick. I'm real cranky. I like to be working on the go, doing my thing. And when I have to be laid up in bed and just, you know, feverish. Ugh. Anyway, point is that this way with GoToMeeting, think about it. You don't have to be traveling in this weather. You don't have to worry about catching some kind of whatever it is. What virus is that I get on the ship? Neurovirus. Neuro, whatever it's called. Anyway, they're probably going to hate me for this on GoToMeeting. But anyway, GoToMeeting, you can just kind of just log into your computer, germ-free, and host a meeting right there and talk to whoever it is without going through the pain and aggravation of getting all your winter clothes on and going through the rainstorms and all that. And right from your computer, your iPad, iPhone, Android mobile device, you could be just hooking up with anybody in terms of their ability to follow you immediately in a meeting. And I love it. It's a great application. You can see the desktop right there that you're looking at if you're hanging onto your iPad, let's say, and just kind of go through it, and it's right there. So the idea of not only having GoToMeeting on a desktop, but also available on your iPod or iPad, whatever. It's unbelievable. So I want you to go to try GoToMeeting free today. Go to the App Store or Android Market to download a free app and start joining GoToMeeting sessions from anywhere. And you can host your own meeting with a free 30-day trial. All you have to do is go over to GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button that they have right there, and just stick in the word podcast, and you'll be in good shape. So I think that's going to be something cool. And then I don't know what else we have. Let me just look through here real quickly. I talked about this. Services, we talked about that. I got a whole list of things here. Global coordinated efforts, great. Unemployment rate. All right. So I think we covered most of it. If you want to get in touch with me at all, of course, you can write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And if you want to see some of the things that we do, obviously just come along and check it out. Good time of year to do so. And let's see if we can get this all ready and bring Peter Schiff. Yeah, I think he's ready. All right, let me bring Peter Schiff on. And a special guest today is Peter Schiff. He is the CEO of Euro Pacific Capital. You've heard of him. He's been on our show before talking about a lot of things. One of the things that I think people relate to his thinking is, you know, what's happening with the dollar. So, Peter, how are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm good. So tell me, first of all, I want to talk to you about Occupy Wall Street a little bit because you had that microphone and you had that camera. That was pretty cool. How was that? Did you get anything out of that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had fun. I got some publicity. We got a lot of people that watched some of the clips. I don't know how much difference I made among the occupiers as far as changing their way of thinking, but hopefully I educated some of the people who were watching the exchange. You know, a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people saw clips of it, so we might have accomplished something in that respect.
Now, you know, I had a gentleman on a couple of weeks back, and he was the PR guy for OccupyWallStreet.org. And, you know, I got a lot of different emails. Some people said, oh, you know, he was terrible. Some people said, I was terrible. You know, I didn't give him a chance to talk. He didn't give me a chance to talk. They're very much, they have a very interesting mindset that's very, I think, absolute. They don't want to listen to anybody.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think they listened to me. The question is, did they hear anything I had to say?
Yeah, well.
Yeah, and there were a lot of arguments there, but it's, you know, nothing I haven't heard before. This isn't new. This is the same old socialist Marxist stuff I've been hearing, you know, since my days at UC Berkeley.
Right, the perfect place. So let's go through, because we only have a short period of time. Let's talk about some currency issues. I know that you have been a big, kind of against the whole idea that Bernanke is burning through the dollar, which he is, and continues to do so. And as a matter of fact, just this week came up with a plan that seems that the U.S. was leading on the charge to save Europe and, you know, crashed the dollar again.
Well, I don't think it was about saving Europe. I think it was about saving banks. Now, some of the banks are in Europe, but some of the banks are in the U.S. You know, you remember the day before that policy announcement, S&P downgraded 20 banks, including Bank of America, Morgan Stanley. I think Bank of America is in a lot of trouble,
mm-hmm.
and so I think that's what the Fed was concerned about, and so that's what they're trying to do is prop up these insolvent institutions.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty amazing move in the markets in response to that compared to what I thought the move was all about, because it seemed like they're just going to be cutting the overnight swap rate and allowing for more liquidity. I mean, a 4% jump in markets on that was kind of a little bit overstated, don't you think?
Yeah, I know, and our move here was a small move. If you look at the German DAX in dollar terms, was up over 6%. The Hang Seng was up 6%. So you had some big one-day moves. And I think what it is, it's not so much of what they've already done. I think a lot of it is the anticipation of, okay, it's easing, we're going to get more easing, and it's, you know, kind of a nod to the idea that there's a lot more coming, that this isn't the end of it, that the central banks are really going to break out the bazookas, you know, and pump everything up.
Yeah, but then at the end, what's the end game there, Peter? Because it seems to me that I read a lot of headlines and kind of, you know, look at the stories about economics around the world, and every time I see something that is a negative discussion about how the economy in whatever country it is not doing well, there's a sentence right after that that says something like creating more need for stimulus. It's like, I don't remember a time that stimulus has been always in every discussion of the economy.
Well, it's a flawed concept that the government can improve the economy through these Keynesian stimuluses. It doesn't work. I mean, in fact, the reason the economy is so screwed up is because of all these stimuluses that were really sedatives that screwed us all up. So there is a way to stimulate the economy. It's by getting the government out of it, which means cutting government spending, repealing a lot of regulations, and replacing central banking with a free market so that it's not Ben Bernanke that just decides what interest rates should be, but the market that sets the price of money. And money should have real value. It should be gold. It shouldn't just be a piece of paper created out of thin air or just some kind of digital entry on some computer screen. It needs to be something real. So if we go back to a real economy, to capitalism, then that's a great stimulus and the economy will grow. If we just keep on trying to micromanage this bubble economy that the Fed and the government have inflated, we're never going to have any growth.
Yeah. I mean, and I think the real centerpiece of really what central banks are all about is what's happening in Europe in terms of their desire to manipulate markets by conversation, rhetoric, and you know, just saying things that aren't, you know, blatantly not true. Don't you think?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, they don't want to say anything truthful. Because they're afraid that nobody can handle the truth. So it's a lot easier to lie for a whole number of reasons.
Yeah, can you imagine if companies did what some of these central banks do in terms of what they say?
They'd have charges. Well, they'd be in jail. You know?
Anyway, so where's your, you know, I know you've been a big advocate of the Asian region. They've had a lot of problems between the tsunami and earthquake and the floods in Thailand and, you know, China since 2008.
Well, I mean, those natural disasters pale in comparison to the man-made disasters right. They're dealing with, which right. is a function of trying to vendor finance the United States and maybe even to a lesser degree Europe, but mainly the United States. You've got a lot of countries in Asia that are very productive, that are producing a lot of goods, yet instead of consuming those goods themselves, they're loaning us the money to consume them instead. But meanwhile, we have no ability to repay the loans. But to maintain this illusion of a viable relationship, of a real transaction, they have to keep printing a bunch of money and warehousing our dollars. And all this inflation that they're creating is undermining their economies. It's creating bubbles. It's creating misallocations of resources. It's diminishing the standard of living of their people. And, you know, eventually it's going to end. The sooner the better, as far as I'm concerned. But meanwhile, a lot of damage is being done.
It seems like all that's going on and all that is happening, it's like a giant vacuum that sucks the wealth and the guts out of countries around the world and brings it here.
Yeah, well, we're not sucking the wealth. We're sucking the goods. I mean, the factories are still there, right? All the factories and all the equipment are still in China. We're getting the goods that all that produces, which that's the fun part. I mean, we get to enjoy that. But at some point, we're not going to have that anymore, and they're still going to have their factories and their equipment, so they'll be able to continue to make stuff. But they'll be making stuff for themselves. We're just going to be, you know, SOL.
So are we going to ever go back to, you know, anybody says, oh, we have to go back to manufacturing. And I'm like, how do we go back to manufacturing? Who's working it? Who's going to do that?
Well, we got millions of people who are unemployed, so we got plenty of people who need work.
Well, of course.
We just have to take away the alternative of collecting unemployment benefits forever, and we have to get rid of a lot of the regulations and stuff like that and litigation that makes it so expensive and risky for Americans to hire other Americans to do the work.
Yeah. So from a standpoint of your backing of some candidate, is Ron Paul kind of up there with who you'd like to see? Maybe not exactly him, but his concepts.
Yeah, well, he is the guy I'd like to see. He's not like kind of up there, although I do like Gary Johnson as well, although he doesn't have a realistic chance. But of the people who are realistically polling well, or even, you know, including in the debates. But, you know, Ron Paul is my guy. I mean, the only other people that seem like they have a shot at winning are Romney and Newt Gingrich. I mean, I think that the Herman Cain star has faded.
Yeah.
So I think those are the only three viable candidates at this point. And, you know, I don't like, the only one of the bunch that I like there is Ron Paul. I don't trust either Romney or Gingrich. You know, Romney is too much a Wall Street guy. He was a liberal Republican governor of a liberal state. I think he's just talking like he's a conservative because that's how you get the Republican nomination. So I think he's just a rhino.
Yeah.
And then Newt Gingrich, I mean, he's a bright guy, but I just don't trust him. I mean, he was part of the problem in Washington for a long time. And what did he do when he get out? He became a lobbyist. I don't care what he wants to call himself. He took $1.6 million from Freddie Mac to make sure that, to keep the heat off him from the Republicans. So, you know, I don't trust him to actually do anything, you know. Ron Paul's the only guy that I think has the integrity, the proven integrity, not to, check his principles at the White House door, that if he actually became president, he would respect them and really try to shrink government and force Congress to override his veto to do anything, you know, and try to use whatever executive powers he had to eliminate parts of government and government spending. I don't think we're going to get that out of Newt. I think he's buddies with all these guys. He's going to cooperate with them and deal with them. And, you know, that's how we got into this mess. I don't want any bipartisan cooperation, you know.
I hear you. And finally, you know, one of the things I know we talked about before was silver, and you really liked silver, and you had some projections on that. You know, one of the things that happened, as you know, is silver went through a very, very difficult time this year where it essentially crashed, right? I was at
a meeting. Well, it crashed. Remember, it skyrocketed up to $50, and then it came right back down to where it was.
Right.
So it's kind of like spiked up and down, but it's still over $30, which is, you know, look at where it's come from. You know?
But what I was going to say was that I happened to have an opportunity to meet with, briefly, with Gary Gensler. And I said to him, you know, hey, by the way, how is it that you have silver at whatever price it is, and then all of a sudden it starts dropping like crazy, and then at the end of the day, we find out that the CME or whoever it was increased their margin requirements. How did they not – who knew during the day about this? And did you – and he said, that's not my area that I cover. I said, what do you mean? So, I mean, you know what I mean? And now, obviously, with the MF Global thing, he has to recuse himself, right? And I just had any thoughts on how the best way, you know, people want to buy silver? Are you doing it through like SLV or some silver companies?
I have a precious metals company. We sell physical silver to be delivered, or we'll have storage facilities in Switzerland and Australia. I think you want to own the actual metal itself. You know, I've got a precious metals company, Europac Metals. Mm-hmm. You can go to the website, europacmetals.com. Also, you know, I have a free report that I just came out with not too long ago on the scams to look out for in the precious metals industry. Because when you're buying physical metals, there are a lot of companies out there that are really out to scam you and separate you from your money. There's a lot of ways to get ripped off. And so if you go to goldscams.com, you can download my free report, read it, and then know what to look out for so that you won't get scammed.
Right. I'll put that on the website as well. And also, everybody should know that you have several books out, Crash Proof, and a variety of other books. I'll put all the information on how to get in touch with Peter, his gold scams, and Euro Pacific Capital on the show notes. Peter Schiff, thanks for joining me, buddy.
Hey, no problem.
Gold scam, that's cool. That's a catchy title. And the whole concept of gold and silver and platinum and palladium, and wow, it's getting pretty complex in terms of deciding which asset class to invest in these days, isn't it? You know, do you want to be in materials? Do you want to be in the healthcare because of the aging population? Do you want to be in natural resources because we're running out? Do you want to be in, you know, the green energy area because, you know, we have to save the world? Do you want to be in domestic, international? Boy, it used to be pretty easy. Stocks, bonds, real estate, cash. That was the old days. Benjamin Graham and a few guys, when they wrote their books and they look back on history, that's pretty much what they covered. Maybe they did more of a slant, obviously, on the idea that, you know, stocks were the core investment, and they wrote a lot more about that. But when you look at the whole idea of asset allocation historically, and you look at what the major writers of the concept of diversification and asset allocation talked about, it was all about four, maybe five different asset classes. And, you know, it used to look like there was a time when you had in the range of conservative to aggressive was the idea that you would have, well, bonds were conservative, and, you know, up the list a little bit were, you know, depending on the bonds, from governments to maybe some corporates, and munis. And then you went into preferred stocks and and you went into stocks and small caps, you know, as a more risky, and then you had somewhere in the international and the emerging markets. And, you know, now that's all upside down, if you think about it. It's like the rearranging the food chart in a way. You know, sovereign bonds, which were supposedly the most, you know, sought after for safety, kind of that changed. And we've seen the change from international being one of the more aggressive places in general, and emerging markets being a place that you really want to kind of consider. So anyway, kind of an interesting situation. We have also, I mentioned to you that we're going to have a really cool little, I don't want to spoil the fun yet, but we have a really neat product newsletter / idea that's coming out, and working with a couple of different groups on this, and I think you're going to be really excited about this. If you like to follow, you know, earnings and trading, and you know when to buy, and what we call the points at which are the best possible trading points, this will be interesting for you. I think that's something that you want to take a look at. And then also, I'll mention to you that obviously the end of year is coming, so make sure that you do all those end of year things, right? So you have to make sure if you have IRAs that you take your distribution. You have to make sure that if you are, you know, required to, you know, put as much as you can into your, whether the healthcare cost reduction plan in terms of the, they call them cafeteria plans, whether you call them the 401k at work, or any of those things that need to be taken care of, maybe tax loss harvesting for the end of the year, you know, make sure you do it. Don't leave it to the last second. Definitely do not leave it to the last second. And I think that that will be very helpful for you, and make sure that, you know, you don't have to rush and do it during the holidays when nothing gets done on Wall Street, it seems. And realize that over the next few weeks, you're going to see probably a little bit of a tapering off of the volume, if all things stay equal. I mean, obviously, if you see, you know, the selling pickup, the volume will probably pick up because of, you know, the amount of money that just recently went in will come out pretty darn quickly. And then we'll, of course, have Barton Biggs saying he reduced his exposure down or something of that nature. You know, so I think that that the end of the year, it brings great opportunity. And I think it's time for reflection in terms of, you know, what are you going to do moving forward? So, you know, kind of like start thinking about where are the opportunities, you know, and oftentimes realize that what happened last year or the last year before that maybe won't be that. And sometimes the worst beaten up. And dare I say, you know, who knows that it maybe banks could actually start to see a little bit of a reprieve. Don't forget that, you know, the markets look out a number of months. So if the situation and the solution for the whole European crisis isn't right here, well, maybe it's going to be a year from now. Anyway, we'll talk to you soon. That's going to wrap it up for today. Thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Write to me anytime, send me some information, or just go check out the actual total, what we call our tutorial, our virtual tour, 12 minutes on how we manage money and what we do, why we go short, how we go long, when we buy, when we sell, over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks a lot, and I'll see you soon next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.